Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we've all got another dose of cup fever in association with the oldfootballshirts.com. Yes, that's right, tinfoil cups at the ready. We're heading to the FA Cup quarterfinals for only the fifth time in our history, following Tuesday night's victory over Stoke, which is also confirmation that we can do it on a cold Tuesday night in Stoke. And it was also Lewis Dunk's 400th Albion appearance. The cup will have to wait, though, as we get back to league action this weekend with West Ham visiting the Amex, hoping to finally get their first Premier League win against us to ease their relegation fears. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares. And in the week when football lost one of its great voices, we're delighted to welcome one of football's great voices. Please welcome back Dave Beckett. Hello, Dave.
Good evening. That's very kind. Very kind.
And you are truly too kind, one of the really great voices, which is great because no one recognises you.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, no, yeah. No, nobody's got a clue who I am until I open my mouth, really. So that's, it even happens with footballers. I remember doing a piece with Craig Noon a while back for the club. And not a clue sort of who I was or anything until I'd asked him the first question. And then he said, hang on a minute, you're that bloke that does all the sort of football on the Football League and everything. So, but partly as well, I think, because I probably speak slightly differently. If I'm in and around Brightonians, I probably sound a bit different as well.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, obviously, you know, you've been on the Roar a few times and welcome back, by the way. But, you know, when I see you up in the, over at the Amex, it's the same voice. I mean, it's clear. I mean, if we're going to sort of go down that particular road, when I think of someone like Johnny Walker, who's been on Radio 2 since before radio was invented, as like you say, he's got his radio voice. But when then you hear him talking normally, like in an interview, he sounds like a rough and ready geezer. Yeah. But then by the same time, you've got someone like Peter Brackley, who was, you know, formerly of this parish, sounds exactly the same talking as he does commentating, though with a slight difference that when he's behind a microphone, he does sound very excited.
I believe it's called a red light voice.
Is it?
When the red light goes on, the voice changes. Well,
I got the reference, AD. Go on, Dave.
I think everyone has that a bit. I think you try not to. I suppose actually I've probably relaxed a bit over the years. If you hear some things from sort of 20 odd years ago, then I sort of did sound like everybody does, where you're sort of trying to talk like the king or the queen, you know, at that point. So I've probably just become a bit more relaxed with my sort of own voice as it was over the years.
Okay.
So I do want to ask Dave this, actually, because, again, I'm just referencing back to Peter Brackley, and I said, like, you know, how did you come up with this voice? Did you come up with this way? And he said, look, it's my voice. Yeah, I can add some excitement. I can do this. I can do that. But when you first started doing your media courses, your media training, let's put it this way, I mean, I assume you must have done, because you're far too polished to be like a couple of weeks like me and Adrian. So were you sort of, what were you told about how you should go about what you're doing? Or was it just a case of, well, this is my voice and I'm going to say it how I feel like it?
Do you know what? I didn't actually really have any media training as such. I worked at Southern Sound and I kind of learned it there. So I worked alongside. So Tony Millard actually used to sort of give me sort of a few tips on voice and pick up on a few words here and there. So but other than that, you know, it was pretty much I probably just emulated people that I'd heard on the radio, I think, at that time. I suppose the one thing you're probably told is to try to I know this sounds a bit silly, but to sort of think about what you're saying. So if you're reading a news item, you know, it's very easy to just kind of go up and down. I sort of tend to think it was like the air steward effect, you know, when they're kind of reading that thing when you come into land and they're, well, thank you for flying, and it's all kind of a bit random up and down.
Yeah, they almost sing it, don't they?
But to actually kind of think about what you're reading, and the more you can do that. And some, if you read something two or three times, then, you know, you do often relax into it.
Yeah, and it's good that you know, let people know where the exits are as well, which is great.
Yes.
Well, okay. Look, I mean, we've got to talk about the voice that we have lost this week, because, I mean, basically, I mean, there is a thing that if someone does an impression of a commentator, the odds are it's going to sound a bit like John Motson. And the guy was truly a legend of the game. Over 2,500 games he's commentated on. And it's like, you know, I mean, he's just commentated on so many great moments that I remember. Dave, I mean,
how's it been affected in your community, in the broadcast community that you've been? How's it sort of like gone down, and well, both in the community and with you?
Well, I think obviously people are tremendously sad. I've got to say, actually, John Motson, almost uniquely, I would say, out of those commentators, I'm not sure I ever met John Motson, because I've always tended to work in the commercial sector. And, you know, he was very much a BBC man. So, unfortunately, I never met him. I would have loved to have met him. I've met Barry Davis in the past. That's why I say it's really kind of quite weird, actually, because most of those, the Peter Drurys and John Champions and these guys, I've worked with a lot of them. So, and Peter Brackley that you were talking about earlier. But obviously, I think the thing is, John Motson is just the sort of, I suppose, for all of us, he's kind of like the soundtrack of your childhood, isn't it? And that's what the great commentators do. And the way that they sort of bring that excitement into the room and include you in the event. That's the thing, isn't it? You know, a good commentator obviously has to lift it, particularly on TV, which I think is in some respects harder than radio for commentators, because they have to bring something extra to it.
Mm.
And that's really tough to do. And I think there's a lot of people these days that probably prove it's pretty tough to do. Well, it's worth
pointing out, though, because it is something that people do forget, that when you're commentating on the radio, you're commentating on stuff that people can't see. And when you're commentating on the telly, it's something you can see. And that is a fact that often gets overlooked. And it is two very different skills.
I think you've got to... with radio, I think the thing is that you've got to... I mean, I haven't done a lot of commentary for a long time, but I did commentate on radio when I first started, and obviously the thing with radio is you're kind of going 10 to the dozen to keep up with the play and everything else, and also you're trying to describe everything that's happening and try to paint a picture for people. So radio commentary is difficult in that way, but you have got a little bit more leeway in that if you do actually, you know, get the wrong player occasionally, you're going to get away with it, which you can't on TV. The thing on TV, I think, and the sort of cardinal sin of TV commentary is to talk too much, which is, you know, what a lot of very good radio commentators, you would think if you're a fantastic radio commentator, you'll be a fantastic TV commentator. And it's just not necessarily the case, or certainly might take a long time to adapt. You know, it's a very different skill.
I think it's one of those things actually people do forget. If we're talking, going back to Motty, is that Motty was also a radio commentator. I mean, not only just generally on Radio 2, but there were times I remember, it'd be during the FA Cup final, which at the time was the only game live on the telly, maybe the odd European game or the odd European Championship game, but above and beyond that was the FA Cup final. BBC would lose the feed, and you got Motty then probably about 10 seconds into that realising that, you know, the feed has been lost, so he'll go to radio commentary. And he did it seamlessly.
Yeah.
The pictures that he would paint would be just as vivid as anything that someone like Peter Jones or Brian Butler or Mike Ingham could ever do. And I think that's a skill that I think a lot of people have forgotten about Motty. Yes, there is that case of knowing when to belt up. And when you are painting a picture of seeing something that's in front of you, it's a rare thing. You can add something to it by all means. I mean, let's take, for instance, last night's game against Stoke City. I know we'll talk about it more in depth from our point of view, from a fan's point of view, but from a commentator's point of view, it probably wasn't the greatest one to commentate on. And yet the likes of Clyde Tilsley, who did it, and the likes of John Motson and Barry Davis would actually bring that level of excitement to it without actually stifling you watching what was, you know, not necessarily the most exciting game. And I think the other thing about Motty is that he was a bit of a disruptor. He was a trailblazer. You have to consider what went before him. You either had Kenneth Wolstenholme, a fine commentator, or you had Pathé News. You know, you might have had the occasional bit of Brian Moore or Gerald Sinstat, but the excitement, the boyish at the time excitement that Motson brought to, colour pictures, it just added even more colour to it. Yeah, he lucked out with his Hereford against Newcastle game, but, you know, them's the breaks. And, you know, it is, as Dave said, a voice from our youth, from that is just as synonymous as the Match of the Day theme tune itself.
I mean, one of my favourite Motty moments, I have to say, is the bit where Because his dad used to be a clergyman, was it?
Yeah, I think it was a chaplain in Brighton.
I believe he was, wasn't he? Yeah.
Here in Brighton. And he used to go and watch Brighton a lot. And Motti was doing a commentary from the Goldstone, and the camera panned to his dad, and like, and there's the commentator's father. And he waved. It was just like, it was just one of those really charming moments, which is like, it's great. But I mean, you've got, you know, all the great moments, which, you know, obviously the BBC have put out the documentary and stuff, but you know, the Platini goal and stuff, it took you with him, and it was just absolutely wonderful. And it's like, I mean, obviously I was listening, I didn't actually hear the Ann Smith My Score commentary, because I was listening to Motti on the BBC, as most good people generally do.
I think what you would say about the commentator's reaction to it is that pretty much every commentator that you can think of, you know, if you listed your sort of top, you know, seven or eight commentators, pretty much all of them would point to John Motson as being the person they wanted to be when they were younger, you know. So it was slightly different for me because I didn't really go into commentary. So I was like, Des Lynam was like my absolute hero, I'd say,
sure.
More on the sort of presenting and reporting side. But certainly the commentators, you know, I mean, every single one has just got so many glowing things to say about John Motson, and quite rightly, because these guys are legendary. And I'm not sure that you'll get that sort of legendary commentator in a way in future, because obviously there are so many commentators now as well.
Yeah.
So you've got to be, in some ways, you've got to be very different now to stand out from the rest. And John Motson was, for all the right reasons, it's kind of tough to make a mark for yourself, I think, as a commentator. There are so many matches and so many people.
Yeah.
Might make a mark as just being someone that annoys everybody rather than somebody that everybody loves.
I was about to say, I think one or two are trying a bit too hard. You know, to come up with a sort of, you know, especially when they're commentating on a major tournament or a big game, that they're trying for that big sort of one-off moment. I mean, Motti's one, for instance, you know, the crazy gang of beating the Culture Club. I mean, it sounds hilarious, but if you actually broke that thing down, you think, well, hang on, we're talking about the crazy gang of beating Boy George and his mates. It doesn't work quite that way, but you got the point we were saying
but
here.
But it still worked at the time.
Yeah, it worked at the time, but in a very Motti way. He gave football nerdism a sense of cool that previously it didn't have, I don't think.
Just one other thing I was going to say was that I think the other thing about someone like John Motson is that, the biggest tribute you can pay to any broadcaster, I suppose, is that they make it sound effortless.
Yeah.
And that's the type of talent that John Motson had. Mm. And actually, making broadcasting sound effortless is a huge skill.
We know.
Somewhere...
The most underestimated.
We're still trying.
Well, somewhere there's a sheepskin coat manufacturer looking for a new model. So, Dave, if you want to volunteer, it's,
I'm a bit allergic to the old wool, actually.
Oh,
so,
yeah. Can I just say, to say that on St. David's Day is the supreme irony.
Okay, well, let's get out a little bit of a dose of cup fever then. And we went to the Potteries on Tuesday night, and we came away with the 3 points, Ashley Barnes. And
Aidy, can I just ask this question?
Yeah.
When did Stoke City become the new Grimsby Town? By which I mean, can they do it on a windy night or / rainy night in February?
I think it was something to do with Messi, I seem to remember. I can't remember who it was, but basically, can Messi do it on a cold Tuesday night?
I know it was them, but I mean, I could have sworn that once upon a time it was Grimsby Town.
I don't remember that at all.
All right.
But you know, it was, it wasn't a game that really set the pulses racing, Dave, was it?
It wasn't the best, was it, really? No, I think we've seen a lot more exciting games. But you know what? I mean, was that the first time we've beaten them away since about 1961, I think? So,
wow. Is it really?
Know, I mean, I think so, yeah. So, I mean, you know, you just have to accept that's how it is, don't you? I mean, it's a good FA Cup result against a Championship team that are going to be massively up for the match. And Albion was, you know, changed around a little bit. So you're bound to lose a little bit of rhythm, I think, and, you know, give a few of the youngsters a chance. It's probably quite a different experience for them.
The way that that Stoke played against us, I'm likening it to the first time we played Man City on the very first Premier League. You know you're up against some real quality. It's a baptism of fire. Now, admittedly, ours was a Premier League game. There's a cup game, and in a cup game, anything can happen, et cetera, et cetera. So goes the cliche. But I think it's how Stoke City lined up, and maybe how their fans felt, or maybe not, is how I certainly felt when we were playing in that first game. You know full well you're going to have to get a massive slice of luck to get anything out of the game, because frankly, you know, where Man City controlled the game against us, we controlled the game against them. And I think that's the kind of the leap that we've made now.
Well, the Stoke fans were really up for this particular glamour tie, which is why they only opened two sides of the ground.
But, yeah, I know.
It was which wasn't great. But I mean, it's something which we do. I know we've been talking about it on socials today, but it is something which we do need to reiterate, I think. And it was another classic case for our colourblind friends.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting one. Neither of us are colourblind, but we did do a show a few weeks ago with Kath Albany Ward, who is the founder of Colourblind Awareness. And I'm not noticing any particular traction in... I mean, it's not as though we're singing it from the highest rooftops, but although I do have noticed that since we've done that show, we're getting more and more people who do have colourblindness. And in men, the nature of the red-green colourblindness is something like... was it 1 in 12, wasn't it?
So 1 in 12, yeah. 1 in 12 men, 1 in 200 women.
That's it, yeah.
Listen, I'm right with you on this one, because I'm actually sort of shade blind. I'm not colour blind, but I found those kits a nightmare last night.
Tell us about what you've got then, Dave.
I'll tell you a game that sticks in the mind for me is I can remember seeing Sunderland and Newcastle, and where they're both allowed to wear the stripes. And I mean, for me, the red stripes and the black stripes, I can tell them apart. But it's not instantly, you know, you can't instantly tear them apart. And the kits were a little bit like that last night, even though Stoke had the stripes on, because they're both effectively light kits.
Yeah.
It's quite hard to sort of pick them out in a hurry. So it's not, as I say, it's not colour blindness, but I've certainly sort of browns and greens and things like that. I have to look at it for quite a long time sometimes, or see it against another colour to work out what that colour is.
Well, it's interesting you're saying that, because I mean the common one is obviously the, let's say it's tonal, as Phil Shelley, our show sponsor, would tell you, it's tonal. So a mid blue and a mid green and a mid red largely look the same to him. You know, they there's not enough dissemination between them. So yes, the number of people I've heard screaming about, well, Man City against Chelsea, that will work because we're talking a light shirt against dark shirt. The fact that they're both, as we would call it, blue, and then we're back into language. We have them as shades of blue. You go to other cultures, you go to Russia, you go to Italy, they don't see them as the same colour. They have totally different names for them and don't see it as light blue and dark blue. It's a kind of an affectation of the English language that because we use the word blue, therefore people assume it's the same colour. It doesn't work that way at all. But the point you're saying there about Newcastle and Sunderland highlights again something that Kath Albany Ward said on the show, was that after the red-green colourblindness issue is the fact that they were talking about Liverpool and then the referee in black, why can't we have it that way? And that there's red and black for a lot of people. It's a kind of the second most common colour clash that a lot of people can't tell red and black apart. So is that what you think you've got, Dave?
Well, mine's just, as I say, I think it was called shade blind. I mean, I haven't really had it looked at since I was a kid. But, you know, when they give you the pad and all the dots on it and they say, well, what picture can you see there? And I mean, for me, it's just, well, it's a load of dots. So, you know, that's the thing. I can give you a different sort of spin on this as well, because you've got to think about the players. I remember filming a piece once. That was an FA Cup piece. And I'm pretty sure it was Colchester. They play in blue and white stripes, don't they?
They do. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And the big story in the build-up had been they were going away to somewhere, I think it might have been Sunderland, to play against another team in stripes. And they'd sort of lodged with the FA that they were desperate to play in their home kit, basically. They wanted to play in the blue and white stripes. And when we got there and we were doing a piece with the sort of chief exec and that morning, and that was the big story, really, that, you know, they were like, well, the final piece of a jigsaw is, are we going to get this, you know, permission to be able to play in our home kit? And they felt very passionately about this for some reason. So we spent a fair bit of time there, a few hours and everything, and we were just about to leave, and the chief exec came out and said, well, we've got good news and bad news. Fantastic. The FA have said that, yes, we can wear the home kit, but we got the news, and one of the players came in and went, oh, I'm colourblind.
Yeah.
And so... So actually, the player then said, if we play in the home, I won't be able to tell the players apart, even our own players.
Sorry, Dave, but maybe if you get an opportunity to listen to that particular thing, because again, there might be some stuff that that you've got this realization over, and like I say, it's 1 in 12 men. Mm. Is also the fact that you know, some research, some limited research has been done, and no player is really, or it's very, very few players, but I don't think there's any professional player who, for want of a better term, are coming out as colorblind. You know, they fear it'll actually affect their career. But we've got this issue with coaches feeling exactly the same as well. And like I say, just as we were saying this, even when I was watching the game last night, I saw it was pale against pale. I mean, the fact that Stoke wear red and white is by the by. I just saw pale against pale, especially when the camera is way back. And of course, people watching from the stands, they're going to be way back as well. We're talking about this, and we're talking about this, and we're talking about this. And I don't think we particularly approach the club specifically about it, but somewhere down the line, there are laws and rules with the Premier League and with the FA. And I just get the feeling they're not being adhered to. And it would be nice to think that certainly this summer, when teams are choosing their kits, that they pay some heed to the whole notion of,
well,
where is the
catch? That's a conversation now that needs to be. That's a conversation that needs to be happening now, because they're choosing their kits now. They won't.
Well,
maybe, it doesn't.
Well,
just
who
happen
knows?
In the
hopefully, who knows? It is. But if that means that a club has to have a fourth kit, then so be it. Alternatively,
I'm sure Man United would be delighted if they had to release a fourth kit.
Alternatively,
as would every other
kit,
club.
Yeah, everyone's second kit is the same. Like, it's all white, or it's. It's you either have it as all white or all black, and then yeah. Somewhere I don't know. It's as I'm oversimplifying this, but
it's quite simple. I'm sure it used to be a bit more fluid in the old days, because I'm sure I can remember matches in the past where Albion would have stuck on a pair of blue shorts instead of white shorts.
Yeah,
I'm sure that's happened. I mean, that's all you need is a pair of darker shorts, really,
or even something like if they've got to wear the Turk kit. I think I could be wrong here, but haven't they worn black shorts with that before?
Yeah, they have done, yeah.
See, would that have been enough for you, Dave?
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? That would make a huge difference, yeah. Because then you immediately can just tear the teams apart, no problem.
Yeah. Okay, well, the game itself then, there was a full debut for Kunde Bonanotte, which was, he was okay. I think it was
what's
like
your,
an
what's your beef
puppy.
Here, AD? What's your beef?
Well, you know, actually, I really would have liked him to score so I could say goodnight from me and Bonate from you, but from him. But it was like,
well, there is that. Can we just point out a difference? We just need to point out a difference here, and it's possibly in the way in the club's thinking, or it might be specifically in Roberto Di Zerbi's thinking. Is that here we are? We bought this quote Argentinian wonder kid, great, but he's come from an Argentinian league, and. You know, even those that have come over from Argentina, and Carlos Tevez is a fellow who's been sort of widely named in his transformative yeah. year in his formative years, is knowing full well that actually to start playing in the Premier League is, you know, it's a bit of a baptism of fire. Now, what's happened is that unusually, or maybe it's just a change of policy, is that we're getting in the kids and we're birthing them straight away, where once upon yeah. a time they'd have gone to Belgium, or they'd have been stuck in the stiffs. Or that have been sort of loaned to the lower divisions, like McAllister. And you look at it now, you think, how on earth would we have loaned McAllister, albeit back to Boca Juniors, but how would we have loaned him out? You know, you look at Mitoma. Last year, he was at USG, but now they're being bedded. I mean, Dave, have you got sort of any inkling from the club as to whether there's specifically a change of policy about this?
I haven't spoken to the club about that at all, but it seems to me that is it not just a case that De Zerbi wants to have a look at these players and look at them competitively? That sort of seems to be everything that the message that comes across from him. I think he likes to see the young players and feels he can work with them. And is this not what the FA Cup's for in a way these days?
In a way, yeah.
These players, you know, because we're still winning. I'm not saying that you do yeah. that in the semi-final or even a quarter-final necessarily. It depends on the opposition, but. It was a great opportunity, wasn't it, against a Championship club to see what some of these players
yeah,
can do.
I am surprised by it. I mean, we had Ayari was on the bench at Crystal Palace as well. We've had Sarmiento obviously started the game again last night. On Cizo, he's got a lot more minutes than I was expecting him to get this season. So yeah, I mean, maybe there is just a change. But I think that Graham Potter actually used Don Ciso, and he was using Sobby also at the beginning of the season. So I thought that Monate wasn't going to be coming straight here and going straight into the first team, but he's played a lot more minutes in the Premier League and obviously now in the FA Cup than I thought it was ever going to get this season.
So my question would be to you, AD, is your in the immediate sort of short critique of it was, with a sort of grunt and with a sort of grimace, he was okay. And yet that sort of seeks to imply that you're expecting a lot more of him on his debut.
Not really. I mean, I just think that, I mean, he started the game. I think he was very, very keen to impress.
Good.
And to maybe trying a little bit too hard. I mean, my general view of the game last night was that there was probably too many sixes out of 10 performances from the whole team last night.
I think that's harsh, actually, because, Dave, I mean, Stoke really did set up to stifle, didn't they?
I think they were quite good, actually, I thought, Stoke, really. I know they were a bit sort of rough around the edges at times and clattering people, but, I mean, as a championship team and a championship team that's not doing brilliantly at the moment, I think they just made it a really tough night, you know, and I think for the young players, that's when it's hard, isn't it? You know, that's when the experience does come in to sort of see you across the line. It kind of reminded me, actually, of... in a funny sort of way, a lot of the championship games when we were, you know, clearly better than most championship teams, but you really had to grind out those results. Mm. And now I know we've got a better side now, but once you put a few youngsters in there and you disrupt the rhythm slightly, you know, perhaps there's not a huge amount between the team that went out last night and a team towards the top end of a championship, certainly. And it just kind of had that feel of a championship game. I think they're just championship teams. Mm. Are tough, you know, and they're just tough teams to beat.
And for young players,
it's quite a big step still.
I mean, credit to Stoke, they did have a very high press, and they were trying to. They knew they were going to try and play out from the back, and they were trying to like counteract that, and they nearly succeeded a couple of times.
But that's the point. I mean, if that's something that they themselves have learned from by having to play, I mean, those players come off that pitch, that they'd have been puking blood because they worked so hard at a level that, frankly, in the championship, you don't work to. I mean, it's the step up that we've had to see from the Albion in terms of fitness from the championship to the Premier League. It's taken us 6 years to get here, and hardly anyone apart from Lewis Dunk and Solly March have made that transition. Apart from that, everyone has been acquired since. But the other thing is that just because you're playing a lower division side doesn't mean to say that you've automatically got the right to get through. It doesn't mean we play badly. I think just Stoke actually did a bit of a number on us. They kept their football relatively honest in comparison to the previous opponents we played. I didn't see any feigned head injuries or rolling around or, you know. So, you know, they kept their football relatively honest, you know, sort of.
Apart from taking it in turns to kick Moises Caicedo.
Well, yeah, I mean, apart from, you know, sort of risking their own red cards. But to say that we were disappointing is actually always going to... It was always going to be a tricky against a side that does that. And let's face it, when we play the likes of other Premier League clubs, none of them do that because the amount of effort they put into the press means that something else has to give, certainly when they get the ball. And let's face it, they gave the ball... You know, they lost the ball very, very quickly when they won it. So
if these youngsters weren't in the squad and they were out on loan, would we have enough numbers for the sort of season that we've got at the moment? I think that's the other thing. You know, De Zerbi has got to look at the fact that you've got a Premier League game. And I mean, he's quite unusually in a way, sort of talking up the chances of Europe and everything else and saying that we are pushing for Europe, which plainly we are when you look at the table.
Yeah.
But you've got to use the squad, haven't you? And we just wouldn't really have the numbers with the number of games and the high pressure games that are coming up all the time if you didn't include some of these young players.
This is the whole thing, because I mean, we've been doing it all season. If you look at the game against Arsenal in the League Cup where we went up there and won, and you look at the team we had out on that pitch, it was a very young side, and basically De Zerbi obviously wants all of his players to be match fit, match ready, and ready to come in, and he's naming like all of these youngsters who we would under Potter and under previous seasons we would have seen go out to USG or to go out and get some, particularly the ones that come over from South America, because obviously it's a different league, different tempos, etc.
By the same token, don't forget, I mean, I think it was the game against Fulham, was it? I don't think NC's got onto the pitch, And yet there he was a couple of days later playing for the under-23s at Lancing. So, you know, hopefully they take that, I won't say on the chin, but understand that, you know, if you don't get on and you're still, you know, one of the sprogs, you're going to be playing for the under-23s. And if that means you're going to be playing alongside a bunch of 16, 17-year-olds as well who are trying to learn their trade, then so be it. You know, and the fact is that you saw, well, certainly the game that I watched, I saw in Ciso playing, and he looked like he was having a good time, as opposed to other times when, and I've got to say this, I mean, it means nothing now, but when Moises Caicedo first turned up and he started playing in the under-23s, he was playing like he really didn't want to be there, not at the Albion, but didn't want to play for the under-23s. It was like an insult. Whereas when you see Enciso play and Sarmiento has turned out for the under-23s as well, they're having a good time. And I think that it's a long way of saying, AD, that underlines your point that he wants his players to play.
Yeah. So sending him out to Beerschot at the bottom of the Belgian league, that must have been a good one for him as well then, Al.
Well, yeah, it's character building.
I mean, it is. I mean, as football teams go, I mean, Beerschot is a brilliant name, isn't it?
Yeah, it's two of your favourite drinks in one hit, isn't it?
Well, maybe one. But I mean, it was. I mean, we did get ourselves over the line, and it was a brilliant team goal, which I think we've seen a million times before on the training ground, and they've obviously worked on it, and it was just. Yeah, I'm terrible at FIFA, but that's the goal I used to score on FIFA all the time.
Well, wasn't it basically a carbon copy of the first goal against Liverpool, wasn't it? Ball goes played down the line, cross comes in, and there's someone in the middle of the goal at the back post, which incidentally is something that we've been screaming for so long. You know, it's either get in front of the keeper or get into the area and what have you. And I think in the likes of Evan Ferguson, he's still a work in progress. And anyone who wants to come in for him in the summer is going to get a flea in their ear, I think, because let's face it, Dave, Evan Ferguson, yes, he's writing his own stories and he'll do well for the Albion. But for him to head to a, quote, bigger club, that'll wreck his career even now, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the problem, isn't it? You kind of hope that some of the young players will look at what's happened to other players that have left and decide that they're better off where they are, because the chances he would get if he stays at Brighton, but I mean, everyone's going to be sniffing around him because he's a monster, isn't he? I mean, he's 18, isn't he? But he looks 28. Mm-hmm. He sounds 28. He plays like he's 28 in a lot of ways. I know De Zerbi says he needs to improve in some of his hold-up play and everything else, you know, but he just looks so mature in the same way that Caicedo did when he first came in. I mean, Caicedo immediately came into a team and looked like somebody who played in the Premier League for a couple of years, didn't he? You know, Ferguson, at times you look at him and you think, this guy almost looks as good as Glenn Murray already, which is ludicrous. You know, he's 18 years old, but he's scoring all sorts of different types of goals, and he's clever about his movement. You know, he doesn't just run, you know, like a headless chicken into the box. He stops his run sometimes and waits for the cross. And you can just see that he's, you know, he's clearly a fantastic player. I just, hope we can hang on to him. And it would be fantastic, you would think, for him to stay here for at least a couple of seasons and become a really established Premier League striker before he goes somewhere and ends up sitting on the bench and getting half an hour here and there.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you didn't know better, and let's face it, thankfully we do, you'd say he's being trained one-on-one by a world-class number nine who played 100 times for their country, scoring 60 goals. I'd love to know who his forward coach is, or if there's no one really at the club that is teaching him all these tricks in the books, like you say, that the maturity of someone 10 years older, then that natural talent at the moment is just astonishing.
If only there was somebody knocking around Brighton that could possibly, who might have used to wear a number 17 shirt that could possibly
if you're going to compare him, mate. If you're going to compare him as a six-year-old sniffer, then yeah, they've both got those attributes. But I would always say this, and I probably wouldn't say it to his face: Glenn Murray's hold-up play with his back to goal, 40 yards from goal. Admittedly, when he spent a lot of time on his own doing that, when you see that versus what Ferguson could do, sorry, Ferguson's streets ahead of him. The only way that you know the difference is that obviously Ferguson at the beginning of his career has the potential. you know, if he stuck around to be Albion's leading goal scorer in 6-7 years' time, versus, you know, Glenn, who, like I say, was a great 6-yard sniffer, but, yeah, you know, who's tainted by playing at Parkhurst Cell.
Yeah, but I mean, Dave, I mean, I was talking about, and you were talking about, clubs sniffing around these sort of players. You know, I mean, we're on the verge of, we had our best ever season last year in terms of our finish in the Premier League. We're looking to surpass that this year and actually qualify for Europe for the first time in our history. And that's actually going to entice people to come here and also to stay here, isn't it?
Well, you would think so, wouldn't you? Yeah. I mean, you hope, that's probably one of the major reasons to hope that the club can get into Europe this season, isn't it? Because you think that surely might, with one or two of the players, it might tip the balance. I'm not so sure about sort of Caicedo after, you know, what happened recently. And you have to wonder about Alexis McAllister, really, don't you, as well? Because he must be such a hot property, you know, and he's got the World Cup under his belt and everything else as well. So, but I mean, certainly for the youngsters, and maybe for Matoma as well, and maybe even McAllister. I mean, he seems hugely grounded, and we know he signed that contract and everything. So perhaps if we get into Europe, then who knows? And if we can get into the Europa League rather than the Europa Conference, and I think that makes a difference too, because, you know, some of the clubs that are talking about signing these players either might not be in Europe at all, or they might only be in the Europa League themselves. And therefore, you know, what if you're going to, if the aim is to play in European football, well, playing European football for Brighton, where you're going to be playing all the time. And again, you're not going to be part of a huge squad.
Now, Dave, I mean, I know you do a lot of work with covering the Europa League and the Europa Conference League and stuff. So basically, I mean, but is our squad big enough to cope with that, do you think, if we were to qualify?
Well, that's always sort of been the problem, isn't it, really? I think over the years for all the clubs, not too sure too many clubs have had that many issues. I think Burnley had a bad time, didn't they, I suppose, when they went into Europe. Most of the clubs that I covered in the Europa League, they didn't end up in relegation trouble through it or anything like that, you know. And then we're sort of talking about Everton, sort of Aston Villa, sort of back in the day, Newcastle.
West Ham are suffering a bit, I think.
Yeah, West Ham have. I think that's probably, yeah, it's almost actually with them, sometimes it's the knock-on of the following season, isn't it? It's not necessarily the season that you're in it, but it's the following season and just the sheer number of games.
Is that what you think is happening with Liverpool this season?
Well, I think that seems to be the case with Liverpool anyway, doesn't it? I mean, they've just had such a draining run of matches over the course of a few seasons. So, you know, and to compete at that level. And also Liverpool have got an ageing squad, haven't they, too? You know, and I think that's the problem of trying to refresh that squad all the time. That's not a problem Brighton would have. But yeah, I think it's very difficult. I mean, my feeling is that, you know, if a club got into Europe, then, yeah, you're going to have to maybe accept that you're not going to do so well in the Premier League. But as long as you stay in the Premier League and you have a great run in Europe, or at least get through that knockout phase after Christmas, then that would be a fantastic.
Well, my fear with that, sorry, just a second now. My fear with that is, I mean, you mentioned Burnley there. I mean, they got knocked out by Aberdeen. If we got to the European, any European.
Yeah, that's what worries me most.
Is drawn away to Partick Thistle or something.
Yes, it's losing in the first round.
I wouldn't mind
round.
One of the Irish teams, Longford. That would be good. Oh, they're not.
Yeah, it's losing in the first round to some team from Moldova that doesn't even have their own permanent pitch.
Actually, I was having a conversation with my mum this week, and she asked me, are Brighton winning at the moment? Because she doesn't really pay much attention, and she's in her 80s, bless her. And she goes, we're doing really well. I said we could qualify for Europe. She goes, and like, oh, but like wouldn't that be expensive? I mean, would you go? I go, hell yeah. Wouldn't that be expensive? I said, well, if we got Slavia Prague away, it would actually be cheaper than going to watch us play against Manchester United.
You've looked this up, haven't you?
I can get there for £30, I think.
Have you looked this up already? You've already plotted next season's away trips to Prague and to Tirana.
Tallinn.
And knowing full well, we'll say we'll get some backwater that... all I would say is that the good news is, and we've heard this from several people who are sort of buzzing around the club, is that the club is already making as best they can provisions for it. You know, the several bits of planning that go into whether we make it into Europe next season, whether we don't, you know, the sort of like the what ifs and the demand if I don't and what have you. And this is what they're already planning for. So And I also think that even in the position we're in and the season we're having and the way we're playing, if we don't make it into Europe, isn't a disaster. You know, people might be disappointed. Well, we were fourth at one point. Why couldn't we keep it going? And then the upshot of it is we're still, in terms of resources, a bottom six club. Bring Kieran on if anyone wants to sort of like, you know, argue that point. We're still, in that sense, a bottom six club. And here we are punching above our weight like you wouldn't believe. I wouldn't say it's a major disaster if we didn't make it. Give it another season of improvement that we've had, then I think that we should therefore be a lot better sort of set up for Europe the following season.
The one thing I would say is I'm pleased that everybody is on board with the idea of, you know, getting into Europe is a good thing, or so it seems anyway. You know, most of the fans are really up for the idea, because obviously the Europa League over the years has taken obviously so much stick. And UEFA Cup before that has been this kind of second-rate competition, and why would you want to be in that? I travelled around. I went to several of the finals and travelled around for about a dozen years, I think, doing UEFA Cup and Europa League, and it's fantastic. You know, it would be just an amazing adventure for Brighton.
It's only this country it's frowned upon in. Oh, the rest of Europe.
Absolutely, AD. And the thing I always used to say, and it used to annoy me, because obviously people did belittle it, and there was a whole thing about the Thursday nights and all this sort of stuff. And it's like, well, look, if it's that poor, why don't the English clubs win it all the time? And more recently, they have had a better record in it. But, you know, back then it was a kind of a competition that no one did anything in. I can remember, Aston Villa had a great opportunity one time when they were sort of going really well, and they sort of threw it away to rest their team for the West Brom match at the weekend, because they thought, oh, well, we might get in the top four, you know. And I was doing sort of Villa back then, and you just think, why do you do that? You know, that
win something.
Two or three games from winning like another major European trophy. It's, and I think they probably regret that now. You know, you would not find a Fulham fan who would have, you know, given anything to instead of that run that they had to that final against Atletico Madrid. I mean, what an experience for them that was. So, and that's what everyone wants. I mean, that's what it's all about, isn't it, in the end?
It is indeed. Okay, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As ever, the show's brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and Phil has provided us with another lovely jersey for us to have a look at. And Dave, do you want to have a go at describing this one for us?
Okay, yeah, so it's a Puma kit, and it's got a red body, sort of yellow sides, yellow sleeves. And the sponsor is Rhodes 2000, your asphalt professionals. And it's got a kind of a sun, sort of in a lighter orange in among the red.
And the badge has been photoshopped. Thanks, Phil.
Yes, that's been sort of blurred out. So there's an M on the badge and some kind of feathers and a lion. So yes. I don't know. I'm sort of thinking Scotland, maybe.
Rhodes 2000, or just because of Tarmac Adam or something like that. It's, where it says M on the badge, it's the colours of Melchester Rovers. I can tell you that it isn't, but one of my first Toff shirts ever bought was a 1960s Melchester Rovers shirt. I still have it, actually. I'm even more astonishing, it still fits. but above and beyond that, do you know what, Dave? I'm going to concur with you. I reckon it is a Scottish club of sorts. Who it is, I don't recognise the badge. I could say Motherwell, but I don't know.
I can tell you it's not Scottish. I can tell you, although what it looks like, and it does look like very much like an international shirt of a particular country that begins with M, but it's not them either. So I might as well just tell you what it is.
I don't think Rhodes 2000 would sponsor an international shirt. Yeah. I don't think they'd get away with that.
But this is what Phil has. And where is Phil at the moment, Al?
Oh, of course, he's in Australia, isn't he?
There we go. So here is your shirt of the week. And this is the 2023 home shirt of National Premier League Western Australia side, Stirling Macedonia. So almost Scottish. The National Premier League is the second level of football.
I feel too bad about not having got this now.
But it looks exactly like the Macedonia international shirt, actually. The National Premier League is the second level of football in Australia and is regional. And the WA is for Western Australia. The team goes by the nickname of the Mackies, and they were formed in 1970. By the Macedonian immigrant community. Home is a 5,000 capacity Macedonia Park in the Perth suburb of Stirling. They've had a few name changes over the years. Originally West Perth Macedonia, they changed to Stirling Macedonia when they moved to Stirling and became one of the biggest sides in Western Australia. In 1999, there was a national club identity policy introduced by the government which forbade identities in club names, so they had to become the Stirling Lions Soccer Club. In 2019, that policy was revoked and the club returned to the name of Stirling Macedonia. Plenty of players originating from the UK have appeared for the Mackies over the years, and such is the multicultural nature of Western Australia. However, very few have graced the pitches of the UK and Australia. Not only did I find one that did, but there's a link to the Albion too. Oh, yes. Nicky Ward played for Stirling. Do you remember Nicky Ward, guys?
Yes, vaguely.
Yeah, he wore the number 8 shirt as well, which pleased a few people. But he played for Stirling Macedonia in 2004, and he went on to play for Perth Glory. And in 2006, he made a move to QPR. 2007, he made 8 appearances on loan for the Albion and was naturally given the number 8 shirt. There you go. During his time with us, he played in the Red Nose Day sponsored match. And our kit was beautifully embroidered with the Red Nose Day logo, which the FA, in typical style, refused to let us play in because they hadn't approved the use of the charity's branding on a match shirt. So there we go. There's the FA for you. But if you look on the Brighton page at oldfootballshirts.com, you can see the Nicky Ward shirt that he was due to wear for that match, which is part of Phil's very own collection. So thanks for that, Phil. Of course, you can see that and over 130,000 other shirts over at oldfootballshirts.com. But moving on to not a number 8, but a number 5, who's just come up with his 400th Albion appearance. And that is quite a milestone. Now, Al, I know you know off the top of your head who is above him in the pecking order.
I was told on a video I saw that the club put up on YouTube, Dunkies, he's the 10th Albion player to make 400 appearances. I could probably give it a whirl. Have you got the list in front of you?
I don't have the list in front of me.
All I could tell you is that Ernie Tug Wilson's at the top and that Lewis Dunk has got another 167 games to go to beat his record. And frankly, it's about time a record that was broken. I mean, it's about 90-odd years old, that record. After that, we're talking the likes of Norman Gall, Peter O'Sullivan,
Gary Hart and Kerry Mayo.
Yeah, Wendy makes it onto that list. And there's a few others. I think, so I've named about half a dozen. The rest are probably players from pre-war that I couldn't name. But to be fair, it's still a hell of a record. And one I would actually say, I don't know, I'll throw this one over to you, Dave. When we first started seeing Lewis Dunk play, we always felt there was something about him, own goals and red cards notwithstanding, that made us think there is something pretty good about this player if he carries on the way he is. A bit like, I suppose, Evan Ferguson now. You know, the one-clubbedness, apart from the 3 Bristol City games, is also a major achievement. So, you know, what's your take on, you know, the first time you saw Lewis Dunk versus where you're at now?
Oh, goodness me. It seems such a long time ago. I can't really remember too much. But I think we reached a point in me a few seasons back. He used to get, like you say, a lot of yellow cards. And that seemed to almost stop overnight. And he was very susceptible to that kind of getting dragged out. It actually happened to him, I think, yesterday, didn't it? At one point where he did kind of get dragged out to the left-hand side. And that was happening quite a lot in the Championship at one point. And that sort of seemed to be the weakness that teams would prey on. But, I mean, nowadays, he's a phenomenal central defender, isn't he? That should have had multiple caps for England. You know, certainly far more than one. He should have been in at least one of those major tournaments, you would think. Can't really for the life of me sort of fathom why he wouldn't have been. He's just so calm. He's such a good leader. He throws himself at absolutely everything. Everything you want in a centre-back, really. I can't really, other than perhaps being, you know, maybe just a shade quicker. If he was a shade quicker, he'd be the absolute all rounder. But I mean, you know, if he was a shade quicker, then obviously perhaps he wouldn't have played for Brighton for 400 matches. You know.
Now, Aidy, I've heard it said from you, and I wonder if you still feel this way, that certainly when he took over the captain's armband from Bruno, you actually did say on this show that you didn't think Lewis Dunk was a particularly capable leader. Have you kind of changed your mind now? He's had that gig for the last 2.5 years.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, basically, I mean, there's different sorts of leaders, basically, isn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, you've got, I mean, when you think of a captain on a football pitch, you're thinking about a shelter, a baller, someone who's dragging the teams forward, and like, but he was always quite quiet on the pitch. But I mean, as times rolled on, I mean, a classic example was Palace a couple of weeks ago when Rob Sanchez dropped that clanger. The first person over to him was Dunkey. He's just like, yeah, it's all right, mate, don't worry about it. And you know, it's you know, and you're hearing, you know, you watch these things like the quizzes, the buzz quiz they've got going on the website and stuff at the moment, and you know, he's there front and center even when he's not doing it. And you know, he's a big character around the training ground. The guy is Mr. Brighton of Albion at the moment.
Well, you look at the end of the season awards. I mean, apart from last year, the player's player has always been Lewis Dunk. I mean, is effectively the Lewis Dunk player's player of the year is Lewis Dunk kind of thing. And I don't think it's as though he actually goes around sort of beating them up or stamping on their lunchboxes or nicking their tuck box money. It's the fact that he is actually a genuine leader, and he doesn't have to be a Brian Horton character who's going to ball lumps out of friend and foe. This is a bloke who I think is just the captain who, you know, is forever going to be in your corner. You know, for instance, when Ferguson got done by Fabinho, you know, he went over to the referee. But I think you also get to see, I don't know if you've sort of noticed this dynamic recently, certainly since De Zerbi took over, is that whenever there is remonstrating to be had with the referee, and let's face it, we don't really like it anyway to see a whole bunch of players doing it, but they do seem to have the discipline that certainly the first, if not necessarily the only player that will go to the referee is Lewis Dunk. You don't have this thing of the players sort of like getting round the referee and giving him grief. It does seem to be something quite disciplined about the whole thing of leaving the captain's job to the captain. And in that sense, and I think this is where possibly you and I digress slightly, AD, is I think that bloke does stand up, does represent his team without necessarily...
No, I totally agree. I totally agree.
The other thing about it is the whole thing about screaming abuse and anyone who's done any kind of teamwork will know that the next mistake is going to come from him. So you just have to be a little bit sort of circumspect about the things you say. So, you know, he is captain positivity. And I think that the improvement that the club has made under De Zerbi does come down to the likes of Lewis Dunk, and with Gross and Lallana as well, so willingly taking the lead of allowing De Zerbi to put his ideas across, and the club and the rest of the squad taking them on board in a way that, let's face it, someone that's in Southwest London is struggling with.
I think how fantastic it is too that we've got players like Lewis and Solly March in there that in a way, and I mean this wouldn't work if they weren't, you know, fantastic players and fully worthy of being in the team. But it's great that we've still kind of got those players that link to the spirit and the ethos of the club, and they know where the club has come from, and they still get it in the same way that the fans do. And I think we're lucky to have those guys at the moment, you know, because I guess at some point, perhaps, well, hopefully some of these youngsters will come through and almost, if you like, become sort of adopted Brightonians. But obviously the nature of these Premier League clubs is you do get more players passing through, and you do get more foreign players who come and they go. And I think it's a real connection still having those players.
Can I just say here in that case, Aidy, that the point I'd make, and I want to put this to both of you here, and it's something that was mentioned on the commentary on ITV. They're saying about, you know, 6 years ago, you know, we were in the Championship. 12 years ago, we weren't even at the Amex. 25 years ago, we were staring into the abyss, and so on and so forth. So it's at that point that someone has mentioned, and here we are, let's face it, having arguably the best season given the level that we're at, you know, that the club's ever got. We're in the quarterfinal of the FA Cup. Frankly, we should have been in the quarterfinal of the League Cup. We haven't hardly been out of the top 10 of the Premier League this season. If anyone wants to call this a poor season, then go away. But my point would be is that given where we are now, Dave, how important do you think it is in that case that the story from 25 years ago is still, you know, very much kept alive? Do you feel that that kind of where we were to where we are thing is still important?
Yeah, I think of course it's important. I think that it's I can understand that, you know, some newer fans won't get that, and we're creating a different history at the moment, aren't we? You know, very much a different history with all the Japanese fans and the cosmopolitan nature of the club and everything. Yeah. So this is a fantastic, wonderful history. Maybe we're the lucky ones. It wasn't, obviously they were terrible times that the club went through. Perhaps we're the luckiest ones of all, because it gives you a great sense of perspective. That means that, you know, when you win 1-0 at Stoke on a Tuesday night, you still think it's a decent result, as opposed to being, but you know, there are probably some fans now that think, well, we didn't batter them 5-0 and play them off the park. And you know, that sense of perspective has got to be important. And look, take it to its extreme. If Saudi Arabia decided they wanted another club in the same way the Qataris do at the moment, and they wanted to come in and buy Brighton, and we could then go and buy any player in the world and everything, would you want that? I don't think any of us three probably would want that, even if you could become the most successful club in the world. I'm not sure.
I feel
I'd lost as much as I would have lost more than I gained. You know, it's important the club's part of the community, is what I'm saying, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah,
Dave, we're Brighton fans. It's feast and famine with us. It always has been. And that's, you know, that's what we're about. We're never going to be the biggest club in the world, and I don't want to be. I don't want, you know, it's wonderful that we've got so many multicultural people coming to games now. The Japanese presence everywhere is absolutely wonderful.
It's fantastic, yeah.
But although I do have
Kenny dancing last night was brilliant.
Yeah. Well, there was an Irish bookmaker. I think it was an Irish bookmaker. There was an Irish Twitter account anyway, who were basically saying that if Evan Ferguson scored yesterday, they're going to give away a Brighton shirt. I'd love to know where they're going to get it from, because there aren't any. There's none left.
Well, do you know what I actually posted to them? I actually said, look, if you choose us out of your list of people, I'll tell you what, let's have an Ireland shirt with Ferguson on it, because if you can get an early Evan Ferguson Ireland shirt, in a few years' time, that'll be worth a few quid, believe
That's
me.
A good shot, yeah.
No, you're quite right. I mean, I fully agree. I do get the point, Dave, that what you're saying is with some of the younger people who weren't there. And I think that I do get the feeling that some of them are getting a bit fed up of having the whole "you weren't there at Hereford" batted back at them when there's a sort of an air of entitlement. The likes of us three, here we are, sort of a bit older and a bit smellier. Yes, we were there. We have that perspective, and we know where we came from. So when it comes to the next club that's in trouble, we'd like to think we can look down from our relatively lofted position and help out where we need to and where we can. We don't know. But the great thing about it is, I know it sounds ironic, given that it's taken millions, hundreds of millions to get to where we are. And mostly out of the back pocket of one bloke. But the growth of that could only have worked but for the indigenous work of the people of the club. You know, the whole thing of the stadium, we did that. Yeah, all right, Tony paid for it, but we did that. You know, all the things that we've achieved, the fans have had a massive say in it, rather than being bankrolled by some anonymous investor. This is someone who, and this is Dick Knight's phrase, has made an investment of the heart. And whilst he may not get his financial return, look at the rewards we're getting. Yeah. And here's hoping that whatever it is he is looking to achieve, that he achieves it on behalf of everyone.
Okay, that's it. That's all we've got time for this week. So thank you, of course, to Dave Beckett, to Alan Wares. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and, of course, on our podcast and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. We'll see you again next week, and thanks for listening. Bye.
nothing years ago. When you lived on Stanhope Road, we listened to your sister when she came home from school. 'Cause she was 2 years older and she had boys in her room. At least outside I heard her. All right. Well, that was all right for a while, but soon I wanted more. I wanted to see as well as hear, and so I hid inside her wardrobe, and she came home round four, and she was with some kid called David from the garage up the road. I listened outside, I heard her. All right. Oh, I wanna take you home. I wanna give you children. And you might be my girlfriend. And yeah, 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 yeah. When I saw you next day, I really couldn't tell, 'cause you might go and tell your mother. And so you went with me. Oh yeah, me was coming on, and I thought I heard you laughing when his mom and dad were gone. I listened outside, I heard you. All right. Oh, I wanna take you home. I wanna give you children, and you might be my girlfriend. Guess it couldn't last too long. I came home one day and all the things were gone. I fell asleep inside, I never heard her come. Oh, I had opened up the wardrobe and I had to get it on, yeah. Oh, listen, oh, we were on the bed when you came home. I heard you stop outside the door.